I spent my entire life trying to fit in. And then I became someone that doesn't drink alcohol. There's a thread bouncing in the breeze of an open door, and if I pull it, I run the danger of becoming a bore. If I leave it, and man, how can I leave it? I know I'm not going to like what's in store. When you become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, life can seem a bit of a struggle. You're no longer the tabletop wizard. Now you're nothing but a muggle. The world is well, but then you stop. You look around and you're standing in a bomb crater, and yet you don't remember the tick, tick, tock. You check your arms and your legs and you seem to be all there, but you know something is missing. Something is very definitely missing. And that's what we explore in today's podcast. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I hope everything is going well for you. I am currently in Jeju, South Korea. It is Saturday, the 9th of March, and I am here for another day, fly back to LA tomorrow. And I'm really looking forward to it, to be honest with you. And I just want to start off with an apology. So, I recently, as you know, changed from being a podcast that was releasing an episode once a week to one that was releasing more regular content. Ideally, I wanted to do a podcast a day for you, because when I listen to podcasts myself, I listen to a lot, right? But there are a few there that are golden to me. Like, I really like them. So a good example is Seth Godin's Akimbo podcast, Sam Harris's Making Sense podcast. If Sam Harris and Seth Godin released a podcast every day, then I would listen to it every day, right? Bernadette Jiwa, she doesn't do podcasts. She writes blog posts every day. I read them every day. If she did a podcast every day, I would listen to it every day. So if you find something of value in what somebody's saying or trying to teach, then for me, you can't get too much of it. So I was hoping to provide as much value as I could, whilst at the same time also trying to give you an insight into how I lead my life, to try to show you, like, in almost like in a reality TV way of how being someone who doesn't drink alcohol really kind of manifests itself. Like, what does it look like, you know? So I went to trying to do podcasts on a kind of a daily basis. And as a result of that, I went out of the household, didn't I? And I'd be in LA and I would be recording podcasts, going to Starbucks to do some work and just popping out and stuff. And you would hear the dogs barking in the background. You'd hear a car zooming past. But and that deteriorates the sound quality. Obviously, right now I'm in a hotel room, so you know the likelihood this is good sound quality for you. You know, it could be better, obviously, but it's good sound quality. But if I'm out and about and a dog is barking and cars are roaring past, then that reduces the sound quality. What I wasn't aware of is the impact that wind has on the podcast quality. And also the most recent podcast that I put out called The Hack, which I recorded when I was walking around a casino in the Bahamas, it sounds really, really echoey. And one of the strivers, Kleiss, wrote to me and said, Lee, I just want you to know that the sound quality was really bad on the last podcast, and I'm worried that you will lose listeners. And I don't want to lose listeners, you know, I want to gain listeners. So I don't want poor sound quality to detract you from your experience. I'm very fortunate because I'm in Jeju, South Korea. I'm working with a world-class video sound team. I sat down with a sound engineer, and he is going to send me some links on some microphones that I can use on my selfie stick. So when I'm walking around, it will reduce the impact or the surrounding sounds of wind and stuff like that. So it will improve the quality of the podcast. So we're going to continue to do that. The other thing that I'm doing, I have about 20 podcasts that I've pre-recorded just walking around. I'm going to delete them all, and I'm going to just redo them on a daily basis in a more controlled environment like this. So I don't want to be giving you piss poor sound quality. So I apologize that some of the episodes have been of poor quality. The intent was to provide you with more value, but I may have kind of tripped up on that. But hey, this is what life's all about, right? It's about experimenting. It's about trying new things. And it's about evolving and pivoting when those things don't work. So a little apology for you. Future guests already locked in, as we've spoken about previously, Scott Stabile, the author of Big Love, and James and Janice Prochaska, the author of Changing to Thrive, right? They are locked in. They are loaded. They will be coming up in March, I believe. And I will be posting on Strive links to the Zoom conversation that we will be having, so you can join those interviews live. And then you will be able to ask some questions at the end of that. Future guests coming up, or we're in the works of kind of negotiating to get there, but it's going to happen at some point or another. Dr. Gail Satz, the author of The Power of Different and Anatomy of a Secret Life. I'm currently talking to Dr. Gail's people about getting her on the show, and that looks really positive. Nick Littlehales, who's a sleep coach, wrote a brilliant book called Sleep. Nick is likely to come on the show. Got a conversation with him next week just to tie that up. Jack Canfield, I know I keep been chasing Jack for so long. Jack will be on the show. We just are trying to, get the dates down and sort that out. He will definitely be on the show within sometime this time of 2019. And that's a really important one for me. For all you women out there, the ladies coach, Cristal Fuentes, will be on the show, and the behavioral genius BJ Fogg, he will also be on the show as well. So if you have anybody that you want to be on the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, just let me know. Drop me an email at truthbyalcohol@gmail.com. We'll try to make that happen. Okay, so moving on to what I want to talk about today. Now, I told you earlier on that every day when I wake up, one of the first things I do, it really depends where I am, but here in Korea, when I'm on my own, I get up and I meditate. And then what I do is I fill in like a planner for the day. It has a lot of different questions there about how I'm going to perform, what I'm going to do. And I really like it because it enables me to, at the very least, deal with the procrastination around not getting some of the important things done in life, right? So it acts as a really good schedule for me, a really good rudder, a really good guide, but also it gets me into a really reflective state of mind very, very early in the day. And one of the questions that I ask myself is, what is it that I am most excited to do today? And I have to be honest, I've been in Jeju now for a week. And the sole purpose of me being in Jeju, I'm hired to interview high-stakes poker players. And you would think that one of the things that I would write in my journal, where it says, what am I excited to do today, would be, I'm excited to interview XYZ professional poker player. But I haven't written that at all this week. And when it comes to filling that in, I've actually struggled. And some of the times I've written in, I'm happy to get to the end of the day and then just slide down in bed and, I don't know, watch Star Trek or watch Peaky Blinders or something on Netflix. Now, the small pleasures in life, like sitting down in bed and watching a show and just relaxing and taking yourself away from the world and thrusting yourself into a fantasy realm, those small pleasures are really important. Ironing is really important. Folding the socks, really important. Taking the dog for a walk, really important. And the most latest intensive assignment that I created in the Freedom module is called Small Pleasures. Those small pleasures are really important. However, I think if on a consistent basis, and this is where a planner comes in really handy, if you are consistently thinking so far ahead on the day that you can't wait to get to the end of it in order to just sit down and watch Netflix, then you really seriously have to question what the hell you're doing from the moment you wake up at 7 o'clock at night to the moment I'm locking myself in my hotel room at 1 o'clock in the morning. Why isn't there anything else in the day that is exciting me? Why aren't I excited to interview these people? And what does that mean? And this is something that we really need to be thinking about a lot when it comes to being someone that doesn't drink alcohol. There was a debate this week on Strive about what is most difficult. Is it most difficult to stop drinking alcohol, or is it more difficult to remain stopped? And I think the answer to that question varies individual by individual. But one of the reasons that staying stopped, becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol, which for me is very different to just stopping drinking alcohol. It's like, for me, the truth about alcohol philosophy and all the things that we try to teach people to become someone who doesn't drink alcohol, it's a paradigm shift. It's a personality transplant. It's completely different than just setting a New Year's resolution to just not drink. Like, it, we are working here at the Truth About Alcohol and Strive at changing every aspect of your life, right? That is really super important. And one of those things that we need to work on is, what are we doing with the 80,000 hours that we're going to spend earning money, right? Because most people on this call, you will be spending your 80,000 hours earning money. A few of you without, who are financially free, you will be spending those 80,000 hours in a hobby or a vocation or whatever. But most of us will be spending them doing something for a living. And one of the assignments that we have in the Freedom Module on the intensive is based on Elizabeth Gilbert's short video, where she talks about the importance of understanding that in those 80,000 hours, you have hobbies, you have a job, you could have a career, you could have a vocation, right? Wow, my hand looks really big on the screen like that. And she talks about, it's okay to have a job, you know, it's okay to have a career, it's wonderful to have a vocation, but she talks about them all, and it's really important that we understand that they exist and we reflect upon where we are in that kind of process. So for me, being here in Jeju is a job, right? It's, I wouldn't say it's a career. I would say it's a job. Someone has hired me specifically to come to Jeju to interview poker players. It's a job. They will pay me X amount of money to do that. And the reason I'm here doing it is because I want that money, right? If I was here because I love what I do, then when I'm filling in that planner, I would be saying, I am excited today to interview X, what, John, Fred, or Peter. But I'm not doing that, am I? I'm not filling that in. So that feedback, because I have the personal planner in position and because I'm filling it in every day, it allows me to really see with laser-like focus where my enjoyment is in the daily activities, right? The daily grind, as I like to call it. And it's clear that I'm not getting as much enjoyment out of the act of interviewing people that I should be. And I will talk about it in a little bit, being here in career and interviewing people, it's not just the interview itself that is part of the job, it's what I'm being paid for. I actually like interviewing people, especially when, like yesterday, I interviewed a professional poker player called David Benefield. We connected straight off the bat. I loved that 40 minutes I spent with David Benefield. Loved it. Had I known it was going to be that fantastic, maybe I would have wrote in my planner, I'm excited to interview David Benefield today. And I know in the future, if I ever interview him again, I will write in my planner, I'm excited to interview David Benefield today, because I like talking to really interesting people who are receptive to my questions and are going to interact with me in a really positive, deep, meaningful way, right? Super important. But the other part of my job is chasing after people and nagging them to be interviewed with me. And that is a part of the job that not only do I dislike, I loathe with a passion, to the degree that I have now started to ask myself, is it really worth the money? Is it worth being here? Can I do something else with my time to earn the money to pay the bills where I don't feel so sick to my stomach at the end of the day? And I do feel sick to my stomach, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So having a job is like super important. This is my job. I need it to pay the bills. If I don't earn this money to pay the bills, then my life, like the quality of my life, is going to deteriorate, right? Because I need money to get around transport-wise, LA. I need money to save up to buy a house. I need money to send my children to education. I need money to fly my family around when I'm traveling on the poker circuit so they can enjoy themselves, etc., etc. I need money to grow the Truth About Alcohol, Strive, to make the podcast higher quality, and to help people who are not financially able to get involved in the experiences that we have to offer. So money is not an evil. Money is not a bad thing. We need money. And because we need money, most of us will need to have a job. Okay, but that doesn't mean that we have to spend our entire life in that job. Because having, for someone who worked on the railway for 20 years and spent the last five of them loathing that job, then it's pretty evidential to me now with the benefit of hindsight that even though I was designed to drink alcohol from birth and that I had become addicted to alcohol, the very fact that I loathed my job must have contributed to an increase in the amount of times I spent drinking alcohol. Either stopping off at a pub on the way from home because I needed that gap between leaving work and then seeing my family again. And I had that last night. Like, I left the tournament area here in the Landing Casino after having an argument with some poker players, and I came to bed and I was physically upset. And I was in this limbo land where I wasn't able to talk to anybody about it, but paradoxically I needed to talk to someone about it. So I needed some time to process what had happened before I could spew on somebody that I trusted. And I think going back in the day when I hated working on the railway, I would be same type of thing that's happening right now, and this is why it's so prevalent to me right now. I would go to bed at night dreading waking up in the morning because I didn't want to go to work, and then I would go to work dreading the work. And if I was to fill in a personal planner back in the day and what is going to excite me today on an ordinary railway day, it would have been going to the pub at the end of the day. That would have been what excited me. Like the whole, and if you think about it, if you're in this mentality of only getting excited about what's going to happen at the end of the day, then you're wishing your life away. Now imagine the delicate process of dealing with an addiction like alcohol and alcoholism as an invisible, violent, and dominant belief system, going through the stages of change of the truth about alcohol, from contemplating how you could possibly exist in a society where everyone drinks and you don't, to actually being that person, right? That is a very, very emotionally intensive, experience and roller coaster, to use a hackney phrase, that you've never experienced before. Like it's monumentally emotionally draining and challenging for someone to become someone who doesn't drink alcohol, especially if you don't have a community in place, if you don't have mentors, if you don't have guides, if you don't have roadmaps, right? It can be really, really terrifying. So imagine at the same time that that's going on, that other than sleeping, the vast amount of time that you spend on this earth is working or a job or whatever, and you hate it and you despise it. And the only thing that you used to look forward to was having a drink at the end of the day. And now you've taken that away from you as well. So for me, fill in this white space, this space, this time that appears to be more prevalent and aware, and awareness of that rises, you know, considerably when you stop drinking alcohol. How you fill that white space, you cannot think about filling it without thinking about what you do, either as your job, your career, or your vocation. And just to clarify what a vocation is, right now I am doing an activity that's related to my vocation. My vocation is to help 1 million people become people who don't drink alcohol. And everything that I do that relates to that is my vocation. I would do this gladly without being paid for it. I would wake up in the morning and do this, and money is not an irrelevant factor, because going back to what we said, money is needed in order to increase the satisfaction of our life to a certain degree. There's a cap on that, obviously. But if I wasn't to be paid a penny for doing what I'm doing right now with the Truth About Alcohol and Strive, would I stop doing it? And I was asked this question on the Right Company, an entrepreneurial group that I'm a member of. They said, if everybody stopped paying you tomorrow, would you stop doing what you're doing? I was like, no, I'm going to do this forever, for life. It's not about money. So that then is a vocation. That is something that is more heart-led, legacy-driven, something that transcends our usual kind of thought process and blueprint around, I need to spend 80,000 hours doing X, Y, Z to pay the bills, buy a house, buy a car, etc., etc., right? So I just wanted to clarify that. So what's happening for me right now is super important for you to have a think about it yourself. You know, is your job, have you a process in place like a personal planner that clearly shows you that you're not enjoying your job? And if you're not enjoying your job, how is that manifesting itself in your life? Are you getting a little bit antsy with the people that you love around? Are you a little bit short? Are you getting a little bit irritated, a little bit frustrated? Are you yourself getting depressed? Are you suffering from anxiety? Are you really finding it difficult to just deal with life? Are you drinking because of that? You know, what is going on? And is there a plan to be able to change your circumstances? Either finding something within your job that you enjoy and focusing on that, turning what you don't like into a challenge and turning that around, or is it time to find another job? Is it time to spend more time on your vocation so you can slowly move away from your job and to do something which brings you more joy and happiness and love, right? I think that's really super important. What's going on for me right now is, I'm going to share it with you because I think it can really help you in many different ways. But one way that I think might share my experience will help you is how you interact and deal with the isolation that comes with being someone who doesn't drink alcohol, okay? And I'll tell you why in a minute. So I'm here to interview poker players. And when I sit down and interview the right poker player, it's a wonderful experience. If I sit down and interview somebody who doesn't want to be there and is reluctant to answer my questions, it's a fucking nightmare. It's a nightmare, okay? And that I don't like. But what I despise more than that is asking people if I can interview them, okay? I have created a social hierarchy that may or may not exist in reality, okay, that the poker players are the kings and queens of the poker community here in Jeju at this tournament. And me, as the person who interviews them, I'm like the shit on their Gucci shoes. I have created that dynamic in my mind, right? So basically what I'm saying is, when it comes to asking Fred if I can interview him, I feel like I am smaller, shorter, less of a man, almost like emasculated to a certain degree. Like, I am less worthy. I've really created this dynamic, this social hierarchy where they are higher up the pecking order than me, okay? And how that manifests itself, not with everybody, because there are some people I have really good relationships with, and because I have a good relationship with them and we've connected and we've talked in the past, that hierarchy doesn't exist anymore. It exists with people who I don't know that well, or they've given me the vibe that they don't like me, okay? And yes, I could be creating and manifesting this person doesn't like me. I could be making that up. That could be my own projection. And that it could be that I'm damaging myself as a result of those thought processes. But I'm 44 years of age, and I will trust my gut instinct, and I am a realist, and I will understand that I'm pretty good at I'm pretty good at gauging when someone is off with me, right? I'm pretty good at knowing with the energy and how it feels, this person likes me, this person doesn't like me, right? I'm pretty good at that kind of stuff. And I'm having a problem dealing with the people who don't like me. And I spent a great deal of time last night thinking about it in my room because there was two people here that I there's a group of people here. Interestingly, the bulk of them are American. So I don't know if it's cultural, but the bulk of them are American, and I knew I had to go and ask them if they if I could interview them, and it went south. Like one of them got angry with me. He said I seen him this morning and spoke to him about it, but he said he wasn't angry with me, but it was clear that he was irritated with me and was shutting me down. And I left. I turned into a child straight away. And on reflection, I realized that this goes way, way back to me being a kid in the playground, being half Chinese, surrounded by white people. Like everybody's white, and I am half Chinese, and everybody is picking on me, and everybody is calling me names, and everybody is making me feel like I don't belong on this planet because there is nobody like me. And as a child, you don't view that as a good thing. Now, as an adult, I view that as a good thing. Like I view that as those differences that we have in the way that we look, in the way that we behave, I think are very important and very valuable. But you don't think about that when you're a kid. And I never developed the tools to deal with confrontation. But worse than confrontation, the passive aggressiveness behind, not behind, the passive is the way I see it. When I was a kid, there were kids who would come up to you and say, "You're a fucking chink." And then there were kids who would kick you when they were playing football, would try that little bit harder in sports to kind of give you an edge, who would be dismissive of you, who would, there was something indirect about the way that they were communicating with you that just stunk of, "I don't like you, but I'm not going to come across and just tell you that I don't like you." And I found it easier to deal with a person who is in my face and, "I don't fucking like you." I found that so much easier to deal with than somebody who is like passively aggressively hinting that they don't like me. That clarity of like understanding that, okay, this person doesn't like me, and that's cool. Yeah, I want to know why this person doesn't like me, and this is like something that is really, I don't know what to make of it, but it's driving me nuts right now. This need to understand why this person doesn't like me. Like in the previous podcast, The Hack, I wrote about the guy, the media guy, right? Who I went up to and said, "You don't like me, do you mind if I ask you why?" And he turned around and said, "Yeah, you're a fucking hack. Like, you're an embarrassment to the poker community. You're fucking shit at what you do. You're just a guy who just sits behind a computer banging buttons." I felt therapeutically quite happy afterwards. After a period of pain and suffering, I felt happy. It was like, wow, this guy, he doesn't like me. And that's good. I don't have to deal with him. I don't have to spend time and energy and stress and anxiety worrying about why he doesn't like me, because he's told me he thinks that I'm a hack. And oh yeah, I have to deal with whether or not I am a hack or not. You know that raises questions. There's some feedback there that I can, you know, pour upon. But at least I know he thinks I'm a fucking hack, right? Whereas in the last couple of days, I've been dealing with professional poker players, and I've been saying to them, "Hey, could I interview this week?" And to a man, they've said, "Yeah." But if I was to stick a truth serum in them and say, "Do you want to be interviewed by this week?" They would say, "Nope, I don't want to be interviewed." And then I spend all my time chasing after them. But of course, they don't want to be interviewed anyway, but they're not telling me to just fuck off. So I'm this power dynamic is created. And of course, because my parents are my school teachers, never taught me how to deal with this when I was a kid. Well, they did actually. My dad told me that when someone calls you a chink, you fucking punch them. When I am faced with this same thing happening when I was an adult, I get very angry. And I start to think very violently. I want to take... Like last night, I went up to a guy and I started to try to have a decent conversation with him about the interview. To just ask the guy, does he want to be in the interview or not? And the way that he was responding to me and the way that he'd taken the position of hierarchy made me feel so angry that I just wanted to take him outside and say, come on, let's settle this outside. It's such a childish way of thinking about it, right? And obviously we can't go around punching people. I'm not suggesting we do that. I'm sharing with you the very ineffective tools that I was given by my parents. And that if we don't decide to spend time thinking about why we feel the way we feel in certain situations, then how are we ever going to be able to change the situation? So how many of you listening to this now will say that you drink alcohol to numb? You drink alcohol because you don't want to think bad, negative, painful things. You drink because you don't want to feel pain. You don't want to feel, or you don't want to suffer. So those of you who want to drink to numb, if you was in my body right now and you was in Jeju and you had to interview poker players and these poker players and you were creating this this social hierarchy in your mind coupled with gut instinct that you know certain people don't like you. If you were me last night, you would have been riddled with pain and suffering, because I was riddled with pain and suffering last night. And your answer to that would have been to drink alcohol to numb those feelings. Now, it's really important that I tell you right now that when I'm feeling pain and suffering in that moment, I want it to go away. Like I sat there thinking, who can I talk to? Now, why do I want to talk to somebody? It's because I want the feeling to go away. And I know that if I talk to somebody that I trust about it, and even if they don't say anything, but I've just been able to talk to another human being, the pain and suffering will go away. So I do also, like you, want the pain and suffering to go away. I think the difference and why I don't drink alcohol and some people do is I can see that if I was to reduce my pain and suffering completely, I would never grow or evolve as a human being. And if I don't grow or evolve as a human being, then I will reach the end of my life and I'll look back and I'll be very dissatisfied. Not only will I be very dissatisfied, but think about this a lot deeper. When I was a kid, the reason I wanted to punch somebody in the face when he called me a chink was because my parents didn't give me the necessary tools, the emotional intelligence to be able to deal with that situation without resorting to violence, right? Now imagine that you're a parent right now and your modus operandi for dealing with pain and suffering is to numb it with alcohol. How are you ever going to sit down with your children and explain to them and provide them with the right tools so they can deal with these things as they're getting older, right? So very often, if we stop thinking about ourselves and start thinking out, you know, in the bigger scope of things, how is our behavior affecting other people? Then if you just take my example, I have a son, Jude, who's 18. I have a daughter, Zia, who's 2.5. I have my wife, Liza, who's 44. And I have every single member of Strive, every ambassador, and every person who listens to this podcast. I influence all those people in one way or another, depending on the way that I act. So that becomes something really valuable to me. Like, I need to figure out how better to handle this and share that, the results of that process, not just the end results, the process, with everybody so they can learn too. The process is really important. It's not, for me, it's not good enough. I think it was an Epictetus quote. I don't know it off the top of my head, right? The great philosopher is, the greater man is the person who understands, or the greater woman is the person who understands that the juice is all in the process. It's not in the end product. It's like learning to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is far more fascinating and fulfilling than being someone who doesn't drink alcohol. Figuring out how I can change this dynamic that I have here in the poker industry, that process of figuring it out and learning is more satisfying, or it has to be more satisfying than the end result of being in that situation. This is what education and learning is all about, you know? So, what have I been doing about it? Well, I think the first thing is when you're in a situation, in a job or in life, where something's really bothering you, and we'll use my example here of I'm dealing with people who don't like me, or are scared to be interviewed by me, whatever. There's a dynamic there that is making me feel uncomfortable, right? How are we going to change that? Well, the first thing that I did was I needed to speak to somebody about it. Like trying to process what is going on right now alone is not a good strategy. It's a very, very, very inferior strategy. Just airing it here, like, yeah, I'm sat on a bed talking into my MacBook, but I'm not really, am I? I'm talking to the thousands of people who listen to this podcast. Like, I feel I'm connecting with you. I feel like I'm sharing things with you, right? So that is important. But that connection is quadrupled when you talk to somebody physically, either face to face or on the phone. So I think it's really important to have people around you that you trust, who are like-minded, who think the same as you think. So you can say to them, hey, I've got this dynamic in work at the moment where I'm feeling really shitty about this part of my job, and it's making me want to future think to the degree that I want to bypass 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours to just get to the end of it. And the end of it is me drinking alcohol, and I don't want that to be my life. And then to be able to explain to them what's going on for you, and for you to trust them to hold space for you, to listen to you, and maybe ask you some really interesting, thought-provoking questions. What you don't want, or what I don't want, is to sit down and to offload to somebody and then them try to fix my situation or fix my problem or try to tell me what to do. Like, I don't want that. I just want someone to listen to me, and I want someone to ask me some thought-provoking questions in a very respectful way that I don't feel like they're trying to tell. Like, the empathy is really important for me before somebody's asking me some questions. So I posted on The Right Company, which is an entrepreneurial group that I'm a member of, and I posted about what's going on here, about how I'm feeling around approaching people, etc., etc. And I got some really good feedback back. One of them was around framing, around frames. So I said that when I go to people to ask them if I want to interview them, I feel like I'm going to them with my begging bowl. Now, think about the energy and the dynamic here when I'm going to somebody in this state. And compare that to you being in a bar, sober for the first time, and somebody asks you why you're not drinking, right? If I'm going to a poker player with the begging bowl mindset, and you go to a person in a pub with the inferior kind of I'm different and I'm kind of embarrassed, ashamed, what we're doing is we're giving away our power. And Bernadette Jiwa, who is the founder of The Right Company, she sent me some videos to a guy called Oren Claff, Oren Claff. And I bought his book. It's about pitching. So he's a guy who pitches big ideas and big businesses to investors and stuff, right? And he talks about framing. He says every individual being has a frame. And to cut a very long story short, two frames can't exist in a communicative dynamic. One frame will always swallow the other one. So if I go to a poker player with my begging ball and say, "Hey, look, I know you don't really want to do the interview this week, or I'm speaking very meekly, like I'm small in stature, my body language is off, my tone, I'm talking as if they're doing me a favor." If all of those things combined means that my frame shrinks and their frame eats it up, and then they will take the dominant role in the conversation, and they will be like, "I don't have time for you to be interviewed," right? They've got the power frame, they've got the power dynamic, and that is then what is making me feel really bad, because I'm giving away my power and it feels emasculating for me, and then I go back into that playground. One of the things that I could do, and I'm learning from Oren Claff, is that I can be more strategic about how I'm going to approach these conversations. Okay? I could be more strategic. So I could go up to somebody and I could say, "Hey, I'm Lee Davey and I am the host of the best video interview series in poker right now. It's about high stakes poker, and I have a slot today at 4 o'clock, and I would love for you to be on that show if you can make it at 4 o'clock." And if the guy can't make it at 4 o'clock, he can't make it at 4 o'clock, because I'm telling him that I have the power here, that I have the interview, that I don't need you necessarily to be in this interview, okay? And that we have my time is important, my time is precious. Here are my slots, take them or leave them, right? Super important. And you, but that is an advanced strategy, right? But you, because you need to be really confident to do that, okay? But having a strategy in itself is super important. So if you think to yourself, "Oh, I'm going to go to the pub tonight and it's the first time that I've never had a drink and everyone's going to take the piss out of me and make me feel really bad," and you don't strategize about that and you don't figure out what your killer statement is going to be, how are you going to respond to those people, then your frame will be swallowed up by your friends and your colleagues. And the net result of that would be pain and suffering, and you moving into the habit of drinking alcohol. Because if you drink alcohol, then you're taking your power back. These people are not going to ridicule you because you're now doing what they want you to do. Okay? So I, if you, we're going to incorporate this more into the intensive to give you some more training on it. But framing and understanding frames is really important. Understanding how you are going to be swallowed up by somebody else's frame, and learning strategic ways of how to manipulate that to your own advantage is really important, okay? And we'll be doing some work on that in intensive. But I learned that, and I'm learning that by posting and being vulnerable about what's going on for me with people that I trust. So you should do that. You should find those people that you should trust. And that could be groups, what it depends what you're interested in, what you're, just let your heart lead you there. One other thing is, like last night when I was lying in bed, I really wanted to talk to somebody about how I was feeling. I didn't want to put it on Liza. I didn't want it to be someone who didn't know anything about poker. I wanted it to be someone who understood the poker industry, but was like-minded and had the ability to hold presence for me and to really be able to be a partner and a support for me in a non-judgmental way. And I found it really difficult to think of somebody. One person came to mind and I called them and they couldn't talk to me because of the time zone difference. But I realized in that moment that I was super lonely. And then this morning I woke up and I said, why didn't I call my fellow strivers? Because in that, these are people who really get me, people who really understand me. And I could reel off a good 10 names of people that I could have called yesterday and they could have been a support for me. So I again, I think it is good strategy to literally have a list in your back pocket of when I need to talk to somebody, when I need to process this, when I need to go through what is going on for me, when I need to ease my pain and suffering, whilst feeling it, these are the people I'm going to call. Because imagine if I was someone who drank alcohol last night after getting upset by these people. I come to my room and I've got nobody to talk to. And I'm feeling painful, I'm feeling the suffering, I'm feeling small, I'm feeling emasculated. I got all these thoughts and feelings. If in that moment my modus operandi is to drink alcohol, that is going to happen. But if I have systems in place that I put into play before I drink alcohol, then that hot situation, what I call a hot situation, I'm going to drink right now if there's alcohol here, turns into a colder situation. You take the heat out of it. The more time you can put between you and drinking by introducing different aspects and conversations and interviews and meditations, whatever, walk the dog, go for a run, the time you can put in there before you drink, the situation just gets colder. So I would start thinking to yourself, as you're someone who's trying to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol, who is it that I can call and have a conversation with when I really need it? And if you're on Strive, then think to yourself about time zones. So, you know, who is it that I can... And when you're going through this process and it's really delicate, you should have a plan every day. You should be like, who would I call today if I was in trouble? Don't fucking leave it to hope that you're going to get hold of somebody. Reach out and ask somebody in Strive to help you, because the people on Strive exist to help others. You're not going to get someone on Strive to run and go, oh, fucking hell, I've got to ring Lee. People on Strive like to help people. So I think that's super important. Journaling and reflection is super important as well. Asking why is super important, because as I said earlier on, it's that growth mentality. Asking why do I feel so uncomfortable, asking somebody if they want to be, you know, have an interview for me, it leads me to discover a lot of things that I never knew before. I never knew about Oren Claff and framing. I never thought of reading his book. I never realized that actually learning and understanding how frames work could actually help me to grow the truth about alcohol, as well as help me to interview more people in poker, and as well as help me just deal with life in general. I would never have known those things had I not been journaling and reflecting. So for me, it's really important to get up in the morning, ask some really serious questions in your personal planner, and then at the end of the day, reflect. And then instead of just sticking with the status quo and allowing procrastination to drown you into a life of lack and, like, you know, unhappiness, is you can now start to take action, because you can't run away from it. When you have a habit of journaling in the morning, reflecting at night, you can't run away from the truth. Because I score myself, like, how did I, you know, live in accordance with my values today? 1. Did I do the things that I really wanted to do today? Not 1. How did I feel today talking to people? 1. Like, if you're doing that every day, you're fucking staring like a miserable life in the face. Like, the cognitive dissonance is going to be going, ooh, 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 what are you going to do about this, Lee? Pain and suffering, pain and suffering, pain and suffering. The cognitive dissonance creates a suffering, and now the suffering is telling you, beep, 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 you need to do something about this. If you're numbing it through drinking alcohol, you're not going to fix anything. Like, it's going to be Groundhog Day for you. I either have to get the fuck out of Dodge, don't do these poker tournaments, or I have to learn strategies to be able to deal with them. And I actually think there's a lot of good that could be learned from talking to these people and interviewing these people. You know, if I one day want to have a TED talk, if I one day want to have a TV show where we're talking about addiction, if I want to move into broadcasting, if I want to be a better podcast host, if I want to be a better YouTube vlogger, right? What a great place to learn to do that, sitting opposite some of the most world-class poker players and really difficult people to interview in the world than the ones that I'm doing right now. So maybe I don't have to run away from it, but what I have to do is challenge why I'm feeling uncomfortable about certain things and learn new strategies about dealing with them. And the journaling, the reflection, and asking why is really important. Really important. The other thing is, and this isn't for everybody, is confront the situation. You know, like I said, the guy who called me a hack in the Bahamas, you know, when I set him down and said to him, look, what's your problem with me? And he told me I felt better afterwards. Yeah, it was shitty in the time. I felt like I wanted to defend myself. I felt angry. I felt hurt. I questioned my ability, but I knew, and I felt a lot better afterwards. This morning, the guy who upset me last night, I saw him in Starbucks this morning, and I went along and I said, can I have some time? And he said, yeah. And I sat down and I just said to him, look, you know, when I chase people around for interviews, it doesn't make me feel good. It makes me feel like a little child. And I want you to know that it's not a favorable part of my job. And I know that you're playing for millions of dollars. And I know the last thing you do is you want me to bother you in and around that mindset. But it's really important that I let you know that my sole focus here is not to ridicule you or make you look stupid in front of a camera. It's to make you look fantastic. It's to make you look great. It's to give one of your fans a greater insight into what you're capable of. And I'm really sorry that I upset you yesterday. That is not my intention. And the guy turned around and said, it was nothing personal for me. I just don't want to answer your questions. No hard feelings. And I shook his hand and I went away. Now I know I don't have to deal with that guy anymore. You know, I'm going to trust him at his word that there's no hard feelings, that he just doesn't want to be interviewed. And I don't have to deal with the stress and anxiety of, oh, how am I going to get down to do an interview? I can just turn around to the people who pay my wages and say, that guy doesn't want me to interview him. If you want him to be part of the show, you're going to have to get somebody else to interview him. And that guy and that guy and that guy and that guy, they also don't want me to interview them. Because here's the thing. When I went back to the UK recently, I asked my dad if I could use his car. My dad turned around and said, well, I use it. So then I said, well, obviously, I'm not going to use it when you use it, Dad. Like, I'll only use it when you're not using it. And he said, well, we'll see when you get over here. And I said, well, I'd rather we organize it now because I'm trying to budget. And he said, no, we'll see when you get over here. And I was speaking to Liza about it afterwards. I was like, I can't believe my fucking dad treated me like that. And Liza turned around and said, I can't believe you didn't take the hint. Why did you keep going at it? He told you quite clearly, not clearly, but he told you straight away he didn't want you to use his car. When he said, I use it, he was telling you he didn't want you to use his car. And you know that, Lee. So why did he keep going at it? I think it's ego. It's ego and a clash of values. So had my dad asked me if he could use my car, I would have gone out of my way to give him my car. Because, you know, going out of my way to help my family and giving them things like that is a core value for mine, obviously. It's a really important value. So when somebody doesn't behave in that way, it gets me angry, gets me annoyed. And I think it's the same thing happens with the poker players. For me, treating people very respectfully and very politely is really important. So if somebody asked me if they could interview me, I don't ever see a time where I'm never going to be reacting to that in a very positive and respectful way. And when I don't feel like that's happening to me, there's a clash of values, my ego kicks off, that type of thing, right? So, you know, that dynamic is going on there. And I know through my gut feel who doesn't like me or not, because I can tell by the energy or who is uncomfortable about being interviewed, I shouldn't be asking them. I should be saying to the person who is hiring me, here are the people that I'm going to be interviewing, and here are the people I'm not going to be touching, because they're just not going to be good for us. And if you translate that to alcohol, you know the people you shouldn't be hanging around with. If you want to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol, you know the people you shouldn't hang around with. You know the people who are going to cause you problems. You know the people who are going to cause you pain and suffering. And you shouldn't be fucking around with them. You shouldn't be trying to change them. You should just be saying to yourself, I need different people in my life. I know that. Let's not mess about. And that's kind of what's going on here for me. And confrontation is really difficult. Sitting down with somebody and saying, hey, I don't think you like me and I would like to talk about it. It is very uncomfortable, but but it's almost like a skill. So the more you sit down to you ask someone for feedback, the better you become at it. And I think I think you get a lot of respect from it as well. It really softens the situation. If you come at it from a space of vulnerability, it's really difficult for someone to attack you when you're being vulnerable. The attack happens when you get into that dynamic where you're trying to defend yourself. So it's not for everybody, but I think sitting down and asking people for feedback is really important, you know? So, like, if you've decided to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol and then someone's giving you a really hard time about it. So I remember my ex-wife's auntie, she would get really, really angry about the fact that I don't drink alcohol anymore. Like, she'd get really angry with me about it. And I never sat down and asked her. I think if I would have sat down and said, "Hey, Deirdre, when you react to me in a real snarling, angry way about my decision to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol, I feel like I've made a mistake, like I'm not wanted, like you don't like me. I feel bad. I feel like running away. I feel like not coming out to these parties and these, I feel like not talking to you and avoiding you." Like, if I would have sat down and had that conversation and then been able to ask, "Why do you talk like this?" I think the whole dynamic would have changed. I would have either have learned why she was behaving the way she was, or her behavior would have changed, right? So and then that then reduces stress and anxiety. You think it would increase stress and anxiety because you're sitting down and being vulnerable. But as you know, when we talk about the truth about alcohol and we talk about value, like, does alcohol have any value? I'm always talking from the perspective of long-term thinking. So long-term thinking, alcohol has no value. So I think in terms of growth and development, we always need to think long-term. So in this instance, yeah, it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable sitting down and asking people why they're giving us a hard time about not drinking, but longer term, we're reducing the stress and anxiety tenfold. Finally, the other thing that I would incorporate to be able to deal with these kind of issues is a strong meditation practice. So when I'm not at home, like when I'm away, like I've been in Korea this week, I'm able to do my meditation on a daily basis. And I do the Joe Dispenza meditation from Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. So what I'll do is I'll think of an emotion that's bothering me, or something, a feeling that's bothering me. So each day this week is lack. So I'll be in my meditation and I'll say lack out loud. And then I will picture the scenario of me begging people to be interviewed, like I did last night. And I will create that same feeling of pain, suffering, embarrassment, shame, emasculation, and I'll feel it. And I'll let my limbic system flood myself with those chemicals. And then I say change very loud. And then I think about how the situation would be different if I incorporate Oren Claff's advice on framing. If I was more selective about who I was wanted to interview, if I was more confident, if I employed the advice that I give people on the intensive of standing tall with my shoulders back, exude confidence, take the power dynamic, take control of the situation. How does that make me feel? And suddenly, I feel great. I can hear people saying, "Yes, I would love to be on your show. Yes, I would love to be interviewed by you." Because the people who are not interested, I'm not going there with them, right? So now I start to feel good. I start to feel better. And my brain and my body doesn't know the difference between how good I feel lying in my bed meditating and whether it happens in real life. So I'm changing and challenging those neurological connections. And it's exactly the same when you could close your eyes and you could picture yourself being in a bar and you're not drinking and everyone's laughing at you and joking and taking the piss. Nobody's really involving you in the situation. And then you, how does that feel? You know, and then you drink, how does that feel? And then you say change. And then you picture yourself much more confident. You picture yourself talking about why you don't drink alcohol with pride. You talk about, like, you feel yourself really getting into the conversation and really not shying away from it, but being a really powerful presence and having a lot of fun. And then you see yourself leaving as everybody else descends into chaos, and then you go home to read a good book or to watch Netflix or make love to the person that is home, whatever, right? Now your brain doesn't know the difference between if it's really happening or not. So you can now change different neurological connections, right? So I think like meditation, and not just closing your eyes and just being silent here, but closing your eyes or even opening your eyes. You know, eyes don't have to be open or closed to meditate. You could be doing the ironing and meditating, but really thinking about what's going on, these uncomfortable situations, but also feeling the sadness, the shame, the guilt, and then saying change, and then feeling differently. Invoking different feeling, different neurochemicals like dopamine, serotonin, you know. Our brain will flood our body with these neurochemicals depending on how we think. All right. Wow, it's a long one, wasn't it? An hour. Well, I feel better now I got that off my chest, but I hope you got a lot of value out of that. I am pretty sure that this situation that I'm feeling, this emasculated feeling that I have about going around people who I've put on this fucking imaginary pedestal, like, and this pain that I'm creating in myself, I'm sure that is present in your life somewhere, in your family or your work or whatever. I'm sure your relationship with your husband or your wife, I'm sure that somewhere in your life you're giving power away, or you're creating a narrative that may or may not be true. You may or may not be sure if your gut instincts are telling you the right thing. We covered a lot there. I hope it helps. If you've got any questions whatsoever, give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. And if you are struggling with this stuff and you need somebody to talk to and you've got nobody to talk to, then WhatsApp me on +44 7795 441 383. +44 7795 441 383. And I will listen to you and I'll be there for you. Okay? Take care. If the Truth About Alcohol philosophy jives with you and you want to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then there are several options available to you, okay? According to the research carried out by Janice and James Prochaska, there are 6 stages of change when it comes to defeating an addiction. And let me assure you, that is your problem. It is an addiction, right? Now, these 6 stages of change are as follows. 1, pre-contemplation. 2, contemplation. 3, preparation. 4, action. 5, maintenance. And 6, termination. And translated into Truth About Alcohol philosophy, these categories become this, right? 1, the death effect. 2, visualization. 3, incubation. 4, ready, steady, go. 5, transformation. And 6, service. And that just makes a nice little acronym, STRIVE. Ha! That's why I did that, right? So these 6 stages of the Truth About Alcohol are not fixed in stone, right? They're fluid, and you'll move between these stages depending on a variety of different factors. But understanding where you are on this spectrum is really critical, okay? Now, 1, the first category you're going to be in, which the Prochaska's called pre-contemplation and I'm calling the death effect, that's when you really are struck by the zombification of societal conditioning. You have no idea that alcohol is a problem, that alcoholism exists. You just think that alcohol is fucking brilliant and that is the end of, right? And that will not be affecting you right now because you're here listening to this. But that is that first level, that first category, the death effect. At the second level, contemplation, as the Prochaska's call it, or for me, visualization, this is where you start to think and question the role that alcohol has in your life, right? And as you're thinking about this and you're pondering and you're kind of visualizing kind of like, you know, how alcohol is having a negative effect in your life and what it could possibly be like if it's not in your life anymore, you may have joined the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and listened to this. You may have headed over to the truthaboutalcohol.co.uk and joined our email list. You might be reading our blog post. You might have picked up a few books and started reading on those. At the third stage is called preparation, right? Or what we call incubation. And this is where you might go a little bit further. And you're now starting not only to kind of listen to podcasts and read some books, but you're actually preparing to change, right? The idea that you could
potentially be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is starting to incubate. And you could, at this stage, have joined a community forum like Strive, or you might have joined NIST Naked Minds forum or Hip Sobriety's Facebook group or something. But you're starting to prepare for change. The fourth category is action, or what we call ready, steady, go. And this is where you really are now starting to take some real solid action. And if you're ready to take action, then you should take the Truth About Alcohol Taster. The Truth About Alcohol Taster is a 27-day program. You can join the program whenever you like. You just go to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can find the links there to join up. Or you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll sort you out. You join basically a group and you can just work on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol for 27 days to give it a little bit of a feel. We'll introduce you to the Truth About Alcohol philosophy, our three modules of truth, awareness, and freedom. We'll learn to help you see the truth about alcohol, why you drink, why it's so difficult to stop, raise awareness of that truth internally so you can start to change some of those neurological pathways, those thought process and belief systems around alcohol, and then freedom. How do you assert yourself back into a society of people that don't drink alcohol? You do the homework on Strive, you get an assignment every day from myself, and one of the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors will lead you along the way. So that's kind of the action stage. The fifth stage is called maintenance, or what we call transformation. This is where the work really takes off, right? Now, it's really important to understand that moving between the incubation phase and the ready, steady, go phase, you know, so whilst you're kind of like preparing to take action, that could take anywhere up to 6 months. And once you've started to take action, the actual maintenance phase, which is what we call transformation, the stage where you are really working on becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol permanently, that phase can take up to 5 years, right? It can take that long. It certainly takes six months plus for you to really nail it or give yourself a good shot at this. And for that reason, we've created the intensive. The Truth About Alcohol Intensive, it's a year, an annual subscription where we get really deep into the truth about alcohol, raising awareness of that truth and working out how to be free of it. And we're up to like 70 plus coaching videos. You work with all the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors and myself. It's a great, great process, okay? One of the big mistakes people make is they'll take the taster, so they start to take action, and then once they finish the taster, they don't continue into the maintenance phase, and that can lead them fall back into some of those earlier categories. So it's really important to do the intensive and get through that transformation phase. And then finally, sixth, termination, as the Prochaskas call it, or I like to call it service. This is where it doesn't matter what happens now, you're never going to drink alcohol. It doesn't matter, you're never triggered, nothing ever happens, you're just fucking done with it, right? And that's where I am right now. And this is where we at the Truth About Alcohol can offer you some roles to, you know, give back to the community, give back to the world, and help me create this movement of a million people that don't drink alcohol. And that is to extend yourself into the roles of either a Strive ambassador, where you lead in the Strive movement and really are a rock helping new people come to Strive, or you can become a Truth About Alcohol ambassador, where we pay you to take control of the taster groups and the intensive groups and really work with people who are ready to take the action phase. So if you are ready right now, okay, to start to think about moving up into the next stage, so, you know, you're in contemplation phase now and you're thinking about going to preparation, join Strive, right? It's £5 a month. It'll be the best £5 you've ever spent. If you're ready to take action, if you're ready to do something about this, then join the taster. Okay, that's £99, right? Join the taster. And then if you are just ready to just fucking be someone that doesn't drink alcohol and that is like something you want to do permanently, then join the intensive. That is £1,000. We've got payment plans available. Do not let money be the reason why you do not take this, because we can always sort something out or find you some help, all right? So head over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk to join those experiences, or give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Remember this, folks, okay? You drink alone, but you do not have to stop drinking alone. That's why we're here for you. So reach out and help. Take care of yourself.